knowledge to our faith, to make sure that our faith is not groundless, to make sure that we're not just taking a step in the dark, a leap in the dark, but we are coming to a well-evidenced conviction of what God has revealed to us. And that's what we've been looking at in the past few weeks. Maybe a little bit more academic than you're used to, but we are commanded to grow in knowledge. And so if you are hesitant to grow in knowledge, then that can be a problem. Now, you don't have to have an IQ test to go into heaven. Thank God for that. But we are expected to grow in knowledge. And so maybe we've pushed you in a little bit of a different way. And the reason that we've done this is because many scholars in the world have influenced generations of people, and particularly students, with the notion that the Bible is maybe a decent piece of fiction, but it is clearly not historical. Bertrand Russell, he was a British polymath, a philosopher. He had his hands in all sorts of different things. He wrote in his famous work, History of Western Philosophy, by the way, that's still used in colleges today as a text, "The early history of the Israelites cannot be confirmed from any source outside of the Old Testament, and it is impossible to know at what point it ceases to be purely legendary." That text is still used today in colleges. Another text that gets used is by the historian R.G. Collingwood. He wrote The Idea of History. That was his big book that he wrote. He said that the Bible was full of theocratic history and myth, full of historical fiction. Despite these types of influential attacks that have been in place for decades, these books were written a long time ago, brethren. Despite these attacks, the Bible has been repeatedly shown to be accurate and factual history. Yet these texts remain in our colleges. Jim McGuigan, in his commentary on Daniel, we noticed that name come up a lot in the Revelation class. He's got a lot of books on the prophetic. He's got a lot of commentaries on the prophetic books of the Bible. He says, "The cavils of the liberal have been exposed by archaeology with monotonous regularity." Now, Jim McGuigan, he's really good about being terse and to the point. He doesn't beat around the bush. He says, nope. Been proved wrong over and over again. Thank you very much. Gleason Archer, he quoted from a man named John Elder, and he said, "It is not too much to say that it was the rise of the science of archaeology that broke the deadlock between the historians and the Christian. Little by little, one city after another, one civilization after another, one culture after another, whose memories were enshrined only in the Bible, they were restored to their proper places in ancient history by the study of archaeologists. Contemporary records of biblical events have been unearthed, and the uniqueness of the biblical revelation has been emphasized by contrast and comparison to newly discovered religions of ancient peoples. Nowhere has archaeological discovery refuted the Bible as history. Yet, the idea of history in the history of Western philosophy and 1,000 other works, by the way, make these bold statements and people believe them." But the truth is far different from what these individuals claim, these at least Collingwood and Russell and the like. In our first two lessons, we looked at 10 key areas in the biblical history that find confirmation outside of the Bible, far from, cannot be confirmed from any source. In lesson one, we looked at the Shishak inscription that mentions the heights of David and the field of Abram. And that was something that confirmed Egyptian incursions into Israel. We looked at the Kirk Stele, which verifies King Ahab's reign over Israel in the Battle of Karkar. The Mesha Stele, or the Moabite stone, mentions Yahweh, mentions the royal house of Omri over Israel, the Moabite rebellion under King Ahab, and the dynastic house of David over Judah, and that is 150 years after his reign that it mentions that. We talked about the Tel Dan inscription, which mentions the house of David and the murders of King Jehoram of Israel and King Ahaziah of Judah. We mentioned the black obelisk of Shalmaneser, which verifies King Jehu's tribute to Assyrian King Shalmaneser III. In our second lesson, we looked at the annals of King Tiglath-Pileser, or Pul, from his Nimrod palace, which verifies King Menahem of Israel paying tribute to Assyria. We talked about the overthrow of King Pekah that he attests to, and the Assyrian appointment of King Hoshea. We talked about the annals of King Sargon II from his Dursharakan palace. We talked about the Sargon cylinder and the Babylonian chronicle, all verifying Assyria's conquest of Israel, particularly Samaria in 722 BC. We talked about the annals of King Sennacherib from his Nineveh palace and the prisms of Sennacherib that detail Sennacherib's campaign into Judah, his conquest of Lachish. And you remember, he talks about surrounding Jerusalem. He doesn't talk about taking Jerusalem, just as the biblical text tells us. We talked about the annals of King Esarhaddon, Esarhaddon's prism, and the Babylonian chronicle that all confirm King Sennacherib's murder, remember, by his two sons, as the text tells us. And we talked about the Nebuchadnezzar Jerusalem Chronicle, which details the Battle of Carchemish. And we're actually going to pick up there with regard to our lesson today. Far from nothing attests to biblical history, we have looked at just a smattering of things. And today we're going to look at five more. And I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. This morning's going to be a longer lesson. But this evening is going to be a very, very short lesson. So I'm going to take the minutes that I have from tonight's lesson, transfer them to the morning. Sound good? The first thing we want to talk about, oh, and by the way, I'll tell you this preemptively too. Number five, it should be number five and six, but I like fives. We've done fives, and so number five really probably could be two different things that we're talking about. But the first one today, picking up with Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar II was king over Babylon. He's the most famous king of Babylon. Of course, extra-biblical history attests to that. Biblical history both attests to that as well. And we will start, as we have done so often, in 2 Kings. Through this series, we have looked at events that cover, by the end of this lesson, about 500 years. Look at 15 different things from about 500-year period history. So 2 Kings chapter 24, getting to the end of 2 Kings. And we're going to start in verse 10, and we're going to read through verse 17. At that time, we'll say 597 BC, at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem. The city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah in the parallel accounts, the king of Judah went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother, and his servants, and his captains, and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the eighth year of his reign. He carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold, which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. And he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. So he led Jehoiakim away into exile to Babylon, also the king's mother and the king's wives and his officials and the leading men of the land he led away into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. All the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the smiths, 1,000, all strong and fit for war. And these the king of Babylon brought into exile to Babylon. Then the king of Babylon made his uncle Mattaniah king in his place and changed his name to Zedekiah. And Zedekiah will reign until 586, where Nebuchadnezzar's forces come back and completely level the city. In chapter 25, the next chapter, the way that the book ends, chapter 25, verses 27 through 30, now it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. And he spoke kindly to him and set his throne above the throne of the kings who were with him in Babylon. Jehoiakim changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life, and for his allowance, pay special attention to this, and for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. And this brings us back to the Nebuchadnezzar, or it's actually been relabeled the Jerusalem Chronicle because it deals specifically with Jerusalem and the events around this time. These are among the Babylonian Chronicles. Remember, we talked about these. They're only like this big. They're very small. And they would write their entire history on these little clay tablets. And then we also have Jehoiakim's rations tablets. Remember, we just read from chapter 25. It says that he had a regular allowance, a regular ration that was given to him. We have tablets that confirm that, and it's amazing. Both of these tablets are, again, very small, about the size of an index card or smaller. And so imagine how easily they could have been missed. And yet they have been found, and they can build our faith. The first of these, the Nebuchadnezzar Jerusalem Chronicle, mentions, this is not the entire text, we've already alluded to some of the text, but there is additional text. But this portion of the text is important for us. In the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar, in the month Kislev, November, December, the king of Babylon assembled his army, and after he had invaded the land of Hatti, Turkey and Syria, kind of that northeastern and eastern side of the Mediterranean Sea, he laid siege to the city of Judah. On the second day of the month of Adar, or March 16th, he conquered the city and took the king, Jeconiah, Jehoiakim, prisoner. He installed in his place a king, Zedekiah, of his own choice, and after he had received rich tribute, he sent forth to Babylon. That reads exactly like 2 Kings 24, doesn't it? And that is a pagan inscription. Confirms Nebuchadnezzar came against the city and besieged it. Confirms that Jehoiakim was taken captive and exiled. Confirms that Zedekiah was put in his place, exactly as the biblical account says, every single detail. The rations tablets are really a fascinating find. These date to about 592 BC, so just a few years after this. But these different tablets, there's three or four of them. The fourth one is kind of obscure. It's been rubbed out a lot, so we're not sure about that one. But there are three that mention the rations that were given to him, the allowances that were given to him, as mentioned in 2 Kings 25. They say, to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and it offers 10 sela of oil to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, 2.5 sela to sons of the king of Judah. Now, if you're not familiar with what a sela is, like most people, a sela is about 800 milliliters. So multiply 800 milliliters by 10. That's a pretty decent amount of oil that's given to Jehoiakim. And that's what the Bible attests to, doesn't it? Especially during the reign of Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach says that he gave him a privileged position to sit with the king and to eat from his different things. And he had five sons that are specified in these texts that all received part of this provision. So Jehoiakim had a privileged position. And again, every aspect of 2 Kings 24 and 25 is confirmed for us by extra-biblical writings. Here are those two things that we have found. Again, very, very small, and yet found, and they confirm exactly what we read in the Bible. By the way, if you are interested, you can look these things up by yourself, and it does not take too much effort. You can actually just type in on the British Museum website that number right there, and it will pull you right to that page. And you can look at it, and you can inspect it, you can see the front of it, you can see the back of it, you can see it turned on its side. It's really neat. And all this knowledge is freely available. God bless us for the time in which we live, where information is that accessible. The rations tablets, too, although I think it has a different numbering for the British Museum. Not all of these things are at the British Museum, but a lot of them are. That brings us to number two. Number two, Belshazzar's co-regency with his father and the fall of Babylon to the Medo-Persians. And that brings us over to the book of Daniel. And Daniel chapter 5. I'll read all of Daniel chapter 5, but you probably remember some details of it. This is where Belshazzar is having this drunken feast, and there is this hand that appears and writes on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. That is the inscription that is given on the wall. You've been weighed, you've been measured, you've been found wanting. That sort of communication from God in a very unique way. Of course, this is shocking to him. He turns pale, his knees tremble, the text tells us, because of all of this. He had, just before this, taken all the gold and the silver vessels from the temple and just had his drunken orgy feast with them. Obviously very upsetting for the Jews in exile and a mockery of God. So he has this experience that occurs, and it is so shocking to him, again, that his hip joints went slack, his knees begin knocking together, verse 6 tells us, and he asks somebody to tell him what this means. Nobody can tell him what this means, and so the queen, probably the queen mother at this point, comes in and says, you know, Nebuchadnezzar used this guy Daniel to interpret his dreams. If you need to find somebody who's going to interpret something for you, go to him. And so Daniel is called forth, by this time very old, very, very old. He comes in and he interprets this for him in the second half of Daniel chapter 5. Now this is the inscription, verse 25, that was written out, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Remember, this is the kingdom of Babylon. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Peres, or Upharsin, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. And Belshazzar was a man of his word, at least in this instance. He gives Daniel the position that he had promised to him. Now, this is significant because what position was it? It was third in the kingdom. That's interesting because when you think of the king, you would think that he would make him second in the kingdom. But in fact, history attests to the fact that Belshazzar was ruling as a regent king for his father, Nabonidus, who was out of town. So all he could offer was third in the kingdom, and that is what history attests to. And there are a variety of different things that attest to this. We'll look at three. The first of these is called the verse account of Nabonidus. Nabonidus was Belshazzar's father. Nabonidus Chronicle and the Nabonidus cylinders are several cylinders. They would make these copies of these different things. But twice in this text, in verse 16 and verse 29, Belshazzar promises to give him third position in the kingdom. Now the first of these, the verse account of Nabonidus, again very small, it's only about 5 inches by 5 inches. So, fascinating that we've been able to find that. The Nabonidus cylinders are only about 9 inches long. It's about the size of a football. And about 3.5 inches in width. There are five of those. One was found in the city of Sippar. Four were found in the city of Ur. And then the Nabonidus Chronicles, again, is about 5.5 by 5.5 inches. Very, very small. And the fact that we have found these is absolutely incredible. But I want to tell you a little bit about the history before we get into these inscriptions, because you may not be familiar with the fall of Babylon, and so I'm going to give you a little bit of a rundown, very quick rundown. The grandson of Nebuchadnezzar was a guy named Labashi Marduk. He was named after their national god, Labashi Marduk. Belshazzar staged a coup against Labashi Marduk. And this coup was successful. And Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, was appointed king. Now, how did this benefit Belshazzar? Belshazzar was the oldest son of Nabonidus, and Nabonidus by this time was very old. And so for his father to sit on the throne, he would surely take the throne after his father. He reigned, Nabonidus, from 556 to 539. Now, sadly, for Belshazzar, it didn't work out too much for him because the Medes and the Persians come in while Nabonidus is still alive. Nabonidus wanted to replace Babylon's national deity, Marduk, with the moon deity, Sin. Obviously a big transition for these people. And amidst that effort, Nabonidus went on a campaign into Arabia. That was a decade-long campaign. And he settles down, and he doesn't have any plans to come back to Babylon because of the big fight that he's had on his hands with the religious clerics back home. He's still recognized as the true king, but he appoints Belshazzar as regent at home. He needs somebody to sit on the throne at home. And so he gave him that ability. He was, in other words, second in the kingdom. Belshazzar was second in the kingdom. And he promises to make Daniel third in the kingdom in corroboration with that. Now, after disagreements with Belshazzar's management of the throne, you ever disagree with your children? Imagine doing that in a royal context. He came home, and there were also concerns about Cyrus. Cyrus was making incursions, inroads into Babylon, so he was concerned about that. So he comes home, and he's very old by this point, so he wants his religious reforms to go through. So he's pushing, while Cyrus is invading, and Babylon is kind of falling apart as this happens. A variety of allies defect to the Persians. Nabonidus and Belshazzar begin losing key battles, and they retreat to the capital. And it is on October 12th to the 13th, 539 BC, Cyrus marches right into the capital, Belshazzar's killed, Nabonidus flees to Borsippa, and he actually ends up surrendering too. But because he voluntarily surrenders, Cyrus, being the merciful guy that he was, exiled Nabonidus from Babylon, but he gave him the region of Carmenia to rule. This period, by the way, is also covered in a variety of written histories, written in the sense that we normally think of writing. It's written by a variety of Greek historians, Herodotus, Xenophon, Berossus. It's written by a Jewish historian, Josephus, and an early church historian by the name of Eusebius, too. So this is recorded for us all over the place, these events. Really helpful in that regard. Now, the first account of Nabonidus here on the left, again, very small tablet, but a lot of information, says, when the third year was about to begin, Nabonidus entrusted the army to his oldest son, his firstborn. The troops in the country he ordered under his command, that is, way out in Arabia, he let everything go and entrusted the kingship to him. And himself, he started out for a long journey, the military forces of Akkad marching with him. He turned to Tema deep in the west. He started out the expedition on a path leading to a distant region. When he arrived there, he killed in battle the prince of Tema, slaughtered the flocks of those who dwell in the city as well as in the countryside, and he himself took residence in Tema. The forces of Akkad were also stationed there. So Nabonidus, he's way out in Tema. And he stays there. Nabonidus cylinders, as for me, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, save me from sinning against your great godhead, and grant me as a present a lifelong of days. And as for Belshazzar, the eldest son, my offspring, remember that first account, the first account of Nabonidus just said the oldest son. So who's the oldest son? It's Belshazzar, according to the Nabonidus cylinder. Instill reverence for your great godhead in his heart, and may he not commit any cultic mistake. May he be sated with a life of plenitude. Now, the Nabonidus chronicle here on the right, when Cyrus did battle Opis on the Tigris against the army of Akkad, the people of Akkad retreated. He carried out the plunder and slaughtered the people. On the 14th day, Sippar was captured without a battle. Nabonidus fled. On the 16th day, Ugbaru, governor of Gutium and the army of Cyrus, he was one of the people that defected to the Persians, without battle, they entered Babylon, just as Daniel 5 tells us. Afterwards, after Nabonidus retreated, he was captured in Babylon. Until the end of the month, the shield-bearing troops from Gutium surrounded the gates of Ezekiel. But interruption of the rites in Ezekiel or the other temples there was not, and no date for a performance was missed. On the third day of the month, Arasamna, Cyrus entered Babylon. The Haru vessels were filled before him. There was peace in the city while Cyrus, his greetings to Babylon in its entirety, spoke. Gubaru, his district officer, appointed the district officers in Babylon. Now, I want you to pay attention to Daniel 5. Daniel 5 Verse 29, then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. So, Belshazzar dies that same night. And again, history tells us when you look at these parallel accounts that the Babylonians basically just marched right into Babylon, or the Persians, rather, marched right into Babylon and took the city. Exactly what we read in this account. By the way, you may have noticed that I missed the Nabonidus cylinder. I will show you a picture of it. This is the Nabonidus cylinder. This is one copy of it. There are, again, five copies of the Nabonidus cylinder. This is one that was found in Sippar, and there are four copies that are found in the city of Ur that read the same way. Now, Steve told me something very interesting, because I'd always wondered and curious about why they would make cylinders. Why not write it on a flat tablet? Especially the Babylonians, they always wrote on flat tablets, it seems. So why have a cylinder? And there are a couple reasons for this, but one of the big reasons that Steve shared with me is that it was viewed as having more power. Because when you turn the cylinder, you can keep turning it. But when you're reading something that's flat, you get to the end of it and you're done. So it's almost like a legacy, almost like a dynastic power reference by putting it on a cylinder. It may make you think of a time capsule. We kind of talked about that before. They would put these cylinders in walls so people would find them later too. So very, very interesting. And we will be talking about more cylinders. That leads us to number three for this morning. 539, 536, Cyrus's army comes in and takes Babylon. And shortly after this, Cyrus issues a decree for the Jews to go home. And this decree is recorded for us in two places in the scriptures, the end of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 36, the last paragraph here. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 22 and 23. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. And then if you turn one page to the right in your Bibles, in Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, we get another account of this. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, Jehovah God, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem, every survivor at whatever place he may live. Let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Now, Ezra apparently has access to a longer version of this because he gives that second part of this. But oftentimes when a ruler would make a proclamation, they would send out something called a rescript. So they wouldn't have to copy all of it. They would just have kind of a public notice that they could send out. And so that probably explains the very minor difference there where you get additional details with Ezra's account. Ezra appears had access to the Persian archives because he quotes from the Persian archives on several occasions. So he probably had the original decree, which would be fuller. So let's talk a little bit about this. We do have a cylinder from Cyrus, which attests to this basic principle that was common among the Persians, especially Cyrus. And the Cyrus cylinder says, I return the images of the gods who had resided there to their places and let them dwell in eternal abodes. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned to them their dwellings. In addition, at the command of Marduk, the great lord, I settled in their habitations and pleasing abodes the gods of Sumer and Akkad, whom Nabonidus, to the anger of the lord of the gods, had brought into Babylon. Remember, Nabonidus wanted to change their religion. So he attested that too. May all the gods whom I settled in their sacred centers ask daily of Bel and Nabu that my days be long, and may they intercede for my welfare. The people of Babylon blessed my kingship, and I settled all the lands in peaceful abodes. And you may recognize that this is about Babylon. This is not about Jerusalem. But did you notice that the same things were laid out? You guys go home, set up your religion the way that it's supposed to be kept, and pray for me that I rule well. That's the same thing that Cyrus does with them. It'd be really fantastic if we found one that actually dealt specifically with Jerusalem. We don't need that because history attests to this principle. At the same exact time, this does date to the same exact time here where the Persians had taken over the world at this point. And so very fascinating for us. Now another thing that comes up with this cylinder is that it confirms a couple of the biblical designations that people were concerned about before, especially skeptics jumped on. In the book of Ezra, Ezra chapter 5 and verse 13, Ezra 5 and verse 13 says, however, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild this house of God. Now, of course, this attests to his decrees, but it also calls Cyrus king of Babylon, which is interesting because Cyrus, he was the king of the Medes and the Persians, but he also ruled over Babylon. A lot of these ancient rulers, they would take a variety of different titles based on all the things that they ruled over. But you could just imagine a skeptic who sees this and says, well, Cyrus wasn't king of Babylon. That's wrong. It's anachronistic. No. In fact, Cyrus used this title for himself. He also refers to Yahweh, Jehovah, as the God of heaven, which is the way that the people of Ezra's day and Nehemiah's day and Haggai's day and Zechariah's day, how they referred to God. When you're looking at the Old Testament, you will notice from time to time that they will change the way that they refer to God. In the book of Genesis, for instance, God is often referred to as God Almighty, El Shaddai. By this point in history, he is referred to as the God of heaven, specifically. Now, it's interesting that he would do this, that Cyrus would send this decree, especially when you consider the fact that Isaiah 44 and 45 prophesied that Cyrus would do that before he's even born, a long time before he's even born. He is called the Shepherd of God, and Josephus, a Jewish historian of the first century, suggests that Cyrus was shown the Isaiah prophecy, and he was all too eager to fulfill it as the shepherd of Yahweh. Of course, they were superstitious, so that would make sense as well. That brings us to number four. But before we do that, I will show you the Cyrus cylinder again. Pretty small in the grand scheme of things. This one's about 8.5 inches long. So again, about the size of a football, small football. About 3 inches in diameter, but full of writing. Again, the fact that this has been found, this is amazing. Number four, Medo-Persian concern for proper religious observance. Now, this is important because it chronologically attests to a variety of different things at the end of the Old Testament. Now, chronologically, Ezra and Nehemiah are at the end of the Old Testament, but they're pushed way before Psalms. So chronologically, this confirms a lot of the events that we read about and like Ezra and Nehemiah. Let's take a look at Ezra chapter 7 first. Ezra chapter 7, we'll look at verses 11 and following, where we have actually a decree of Artaxerxes that is recorded for us. Remember I said that Ezra probably had access to the Persian archives? In Ezra chapter 7, verse 11, now this is the copy of the decree which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra, the priest, the scribe, learned in the words of the commandments of the Lord and the statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace. And now I have issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem may go with you. Sounds a lot like Cyrus's decree earlier on. For as much as you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of your God, which is in your hand, and to bring the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold which you find in the whole province of Babylon, along with the freewill offering of the people and the freewill offering of the people and of the priests who offer willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem. With this money, therefore, you shall diligently buy bulls, rams, and lambs with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. Whatever seems good to you and to your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you may do according to the will of your God. Also, the utensils which are given to you for the service of the house of your God, deliver in full before the God of Jerusalem. The rest of the needs of the house of your God for which you have occasion to provide, provide for it from the royal treasury. I, even I, King Artaxerxes, issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the province beyond the river. And whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, may require of you, it shall be done diligently, even up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt as needed. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done with zeal for the house of the God of heaven, so that there will not be wrath against the kingdom of the king and his sons. We also inform you that it is not allowed to impose tax, tribute, or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, Nethinim, or servants of the house of your God. You, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God, which is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges, that they may judge all the people who are in the province beyond the river, even all those who know the laws of your God, and you may teach anyone who is ignorant of them. Whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed upon him strictly, whether for death, or for banishment, or for confiscation of goods, or for imprisonment. Now, of course, in verses 27 and 28, Ezra says thanks to God, he prays to God, and he says thank you for putting this in the heart of the king. In Nehemiah chapter 8, we find out a little bit more about what Ezra actually did. He reinstituted the Feast of Booths. That's a big event at that Watergate revival that they have there. And this is all verified for us, this Persian concern for proper religious observance. You notice he said, do these things diligently, do these things without delay, make sure they're done correctly. He said that throughout this letter, which is fascinating to me that you have the letters of these pagan kings in Scripture for us. Daniel 4 does that with Nebuchadnezzar too earlier on, but you have Artaxerxes here. But I have a few confirmations of this from a variety of different places. One is found in Egypt, at the Uzahor inscription. This is actually at the Vatican Museum now. Herodotus's writings about Darius and the Delian people. We read about Darius, of course, in the book of Daniel. We have the Gadatha Stela. That's from Asia Minor. And we have the Passover papyrus from Egypt and the Elephantine scrolls. Very big deal. Now, Medo-Persian policy was to pay homage to various deities for both political and superstitious reasons. This was not limited to Cyrus's time, but was common practice among all of the Persian rulers. And we'll see from one of these quotations why it was common practice and how it was common practice, especially Cyrus's son, Cambyses II, Darius I, and Artaxerxes, the kings that all are really mentioned in the Bible. Cambyses may be having a little bit of a different name. So, all of this fits with Ezra and Nehemiah. All of what is recorded at this point in history. Ezra was not sent back to rebuild. Did you ever notice that? Ezra's book, which is 10 chapters long, he doesn't even enter the picture until chapter 7. Chapters 1 through 6, you have Zerubbabel and Joshua are rebuilding. Haggai and Zechariah encourage the rebuilding. Ezra was not sent back to rebuild, not in the sense of physical rebuilding. He was a consolidator. He was a reformer. He was going to help educate the people. And that's exactly what Artaxerxes' decree says. If anybody is negligent and anybody is ignorant of these things, then you teach them. So let's take a look at some of these finds. The one on the left is green basalt. It's kind of a darker color, and it has hieroglyphics all over it. Remember, these would be colored back in the day. This talks about a chief physician of the Egyptians by the name of Uzahor, Uzahor Rezanet. And he says, His Majesty the King of Upper and Lower Egypt, Darius, that is the Persian king at this point, may he live forever, sent me back to Egypt, while His Majesty was in Elam, having become great king of all foreign countries and great sovereign of Egypt, ordering me to restore the houses of life, in other words, the temples in Egypt. This guy gets sent back to fix the temples and to educate the people. I did what His Majesty had ordered. I provided the houses of life with students, all sons of fine people. There were no sons of common men. His Majesty ordered to provide them with all necessary means to make sure they could do their work, exactly what we read about here in Ezra 7. I gave them all they needed and all the scribes' accessories as it had always been. So a pattern among the Persians. His Majesty did this because he knew how useful this art can be to survive illness and to ensure that the names of the gods, their temples, the revenues of their estates, and their rituals are remembered for eternity. I'll mention, I don't have a picture of Herodotus' writings, but here's another one from Delos. This is from the Greeks. Remember, the first one was from Egypt. It's from the Greeks now. Holy men, why have you fled away and so misjudged my intent? It is my own desire and the king's, Darius the Great, command to me to do no harm to the land where the two gods, Apollo and Artemis, were born, neither to the land itself nor to its inhabitants. So return now to your homes and dwell on your island. He made this proclamation to the Delians and then piled up 300 talents of frankincense on the altar and burnt it. He's concerned about proper observance. Darius is concerned about proper observance just as much as Artaxerxes in Ezra chapter 7. And the Gadatas stela in the middle here, talked about a few Gadatas or a few stelas. This is confirmed for us in Herodotus as well. It says, the king of kings, Darius, son of Hystaspes, that's the one mentioned in Daniel, says this to his slave Gadatas, I find that you are not obeying my commands in all respects, insofar as you are cultivating my land and planting the furthest parts of Asia with the fruit trees from across the Euphrates. I praise your design, and as a result, great favor will lie in store for you in the house of the king. But insofar as you are flouting my disposition with respect to the gods, I shall make you experience the wrath of my spirit unless you change your course. For you are exacting tribute from the sacred gardeners of Apollo and ordering them to cultivate profane land, ignorant of my ancestors' attitude to their god, who enjoined strict uprightness on the Persians. Now, the last thing that we said there was the ancestors' attitude. The kings of the Persians all had this viewpoint. Another significant thing about the Gadatas stela is it mentions that the priests were supposed to be exempt from tribute. And look back at Ezra chapter 7. Ezra chapter 7, verse 24. We also inform you that it is not allowed to impose tax, tribute, or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, Nethinim, or servants of this house of God. So verifies that. And then the Passover papyrus, very small, this little piece of paper. It's a little piece of papyrus, obviously, but it mentions down here the Jews actually down in Egypt appealed to build a temple and make sure that they could observe the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the Persians made sure that they would observe it correctly. They made sure that there were educators in the area to do this, educators like Ezra. And now this year, year 5 of King Darius, it has been sent from the king. Now you thus count 14 days in Nisan, and on the 14th at twilight, observe the Passover. And from the 15th day until the 21st day of Nisan, observe the festival of unleavened bread. 7 days eat unleavened bread. Now be pure and take heed. Do not work on the 15th day and on the 21st day of Nisan. Do not drink any fermented drink. Do not eat anything of leaven, nor let it be seen in your houses from the 14th day of Nisan at sunset until the 21st day of Nisan at sunset, and bring into your chambers any leaven which you have in your houses and seal them up during these days. So the Persians are concerned about making sure there's no leaven for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Persians are concerned about the Law of Moses being kept fastidiously. And our last one, recycled those minutes, Medo-Persian concerns over rebellion. You look at the book of Ezra and you look at the book of Nehemiah, and there are all sorts of people trying to cause problems, right? You got people like Tatanai, you got people like Sanballat, people like Tobiah, Geshem, all these individuals stirring up issues, and the Persians were plagued by issues, especially during this time in history. Even Haman, during the time of Ezra, trying to stir up issues and rebellion, trying to take the throne. You think about some of the passages that speak to this. In Ezra chapter 5, verse 3, "At that time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their colleagues came to them and spoke to them thus, 'Who issued you a decree to rebuild this temple and to finish the structure?' Then we told them accordingly what the names of the men were who were reconstructing this building. The eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until a report could come to Darius, and then a written reply be returned concerning it." And we have a copy of the letter of Tattenai to Darius. And then over in chapter 6, Darius finds Cyrus's decree, and he says, "Yep, you're right, you are able to rebuild." And in verse 13 of Ezra chapter 6 says, "Then Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai and their colleagues carried out the decree with all diligence, just as King Darius had said." And of course, you could look at Haggai, Zechariah, Esther. Over in the book of Nehemiah, we'll take a look at just a few verses here. Nehemiah 2, verses 9 and 10, "Then I came to the governors of the provinces," this is Nehemiah speaking, "beyond the river, and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel." Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, "Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, 'Why are these feeble Jews doing this? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?' Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him and said, 'Even what they are building, if a fox should jump upon it, he would break their whole stone wall down.'" Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. "Now it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem the Arab, and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors and the gates. Then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me, saying, 'Come, let us meet together at Chephirim in the plain of Ono.' But they were planning to harm me." And then in chapter 13 of Nehemiah, chapter 13, verse 4, talks about Tobiah's influence in dividing the people and causing issues. Now, prior to this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him where formerly they put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the utensils, and the tithes of grain, oil, and wine prescribed for the Levites, the singers, and the gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priests. But during all this time, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah by preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. It was very displeasing to me, so I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room, and I gave an order, and they cleansed the room, and I returned there the utensils of the house of God with the grain offerings and the frankincense." So all these are rulers in Persia. You've got governors, and you've got all sorts of individuals over a lot of these different sectors in the place beyond the river, is what it's referred to, that province. This is all referred to in the Behistun inscription, all these problems that were happening at this point, particularly with Darius and during the reign of Darius, but other times too. The Behistun inscription is massive, and I'll show you several pictures of it because it is so big. It's 50 feet tall. So all these inscriptions we've looked at so far are pretty small, but this one's 50 feet tall. It's 82 feet wide, and to top it all off, it's 330 feet off the ground. And Steve and I were talking this past week, and we were kind of joking around about this. Could you imagine Darius saying, "I have a job for you," and the guy says, "What? What are we doing?" And these inscribers are told the plan to make this inscription on the side of a mountain. Could you imagine being given that task? I mean, you're talking about like 10 extension ladders on top of each other and then making an inscription. This inscription, by the way, is 1,100 different lines in 3 different languages, carved on the side of a rock face. Now, this is a very important find because you probably have heard of the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone helped us to decipher Egyptian hieroglyphics. Very important because the Egyptians were around for a long time. We had all these hieroglyphics, but we couldn't translate them. The Rosetta Stone helped us to translate those things. The Behistun inscription is similar to that, and it helped us understand cuneiform. So a lot of the tablets that we've looked at are written in cuneiform. And the Behistun inscription helped us to be able to translate all those tablets. Very important finds. Now, there were all sorts of concerns over revolt during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Derek Kidner says the intervention came as soon as it was clear that the builders were in earnest. It was understandable. The empire had been seething with revolt throughout the first 2 years of Darius's reign, and now came this burst of activity. They were concerned that it wasn't just a temple, it was a fortress for rebellion. Now, there is, in addition to concerns over the Medes and the Persians having rebellion in their empire, there are actually specific finds that verify Geshem of Arabia, Tobiah, Sanballat, and Tatanai. And there may be one that confirms Mordecai, but that is a very common name during that period, so we want to be careful about not going too far. Let me show you a few pictures of the Behistun inscription. This is Mount Behistun in Iraq, or Iran, rather. Look how big this is. You talk about several thousand feet. This is the inscription right here. This is 330 feet off the ground. If you look a little bit closer, you can kind of see it. But again, 1,100 lines of inscription in three different languages just gives you kind of an idea of the scale of this. It's absolutely massive. If you were to stand next to this, these figures are the same size as people. Each of these figures is about 6 feet tall. But I think I have, a picture on the next slide. Of course, Darius isn't 6 feet tall. He's portrayed as being like 10 feet tall. But on this inscription, you have all this writing in Persian, cuneiform, all sorts of different things. And you have a picture of their patron deity, Ahura Mazda. A little bit closer here, you've got, of course, King Darius right here. He is stepping on somebody's head. And all these kings have lined up to show their submission, to show their homage to him. And he even specifies who they are in the inscriptions. He says, "This is Asena." He lied, saying, "I am the king of Elam." "This is Nadinchubel." He lied, saying, "I am Nebuchadnezzar, the son of Nabonidus. I am king of Babylon." "This is Tritonetikamus." He lied, saying, "I am king of Sogdia, from the family of Cyaxares." "This is Arica." He lied, saying, "I am Nebuchadnezzar, the son of Nabonidus. I am king in Babylon." "This is Frada." He lied, saying, "I am king of Margiana." "This is Skunka, the Sekhen." And obviously the implication is that he, too, tried to take the kingdom during a period of rebellion. They were concerned about rebellion because people were rebelling. That's why Tatanai was so effective. That's why Sanballat was so effective. That's why Tobiah was so effective. That's why Geshem. They were so effective at claiming that the Jews were rebelling against the king, because this was a period in history where people were rebelling. Here's a last slide for us in regards to finds. I'll have one conclusion slide after this, but I'll just give you a little bit of a heads up. Top left is a serving dish. We talked about this in the book of Revelation, that you would offer a wine offering, and this is a silver vessel. This mentions Geshem, who is mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. This dates to 410 BC, and it's dedicated to the Arabian goddess Hanalat, with an inscription which reads, "Cain, son of Geshem, king of Kedar," or we would say Geshem the Arab. Tobiah is attested to us on the right, top right, and bottom right. We have this palace that was for the Tobiads, the Tobiah family. This is from a little bit later on in history, but it attests to the influence of Tobiah. And then bottom right, we have the Zenon papyri, which mentions the house of Tobiah. He had established a lot of influence during this period and afterward. Sanballat is mentioned in the middle, and this papyri from Elephantine Egypt says to Bagoi, governor of Judah, from the priests who were in Elephantine the fortress, "We seek permission from Jehohanan, the high priest in Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple as it was formerly built, to offer meal offering, incense, and burnt offering on the altar of Yahweh the God. We also told Deliah and Shelemiah, sons of Sanballat, governor of Samaria." And it's dated the 20th of Marheshvan, year 17 of King Darius II in 407. So all these confirmations. The bottom left picture is, I know it kind of looks like a corn cob, but this is actually, again, one of those little cylinders. This one's even smaller, and it mentions Tatanai, governor of the region beyond the river. Several places in Ezra mention Tatanai, governor beyond the river. And we do have another one for Mordecai, but we're not sure about that one. There is a list of government officials on a tablet that mentions a Marduka, different spelling of Mordecai, different vowel pointing for that, and it mentions him as being a high-up official during the exact same period, under the exact same tenure, and it connects him, of course, to Mordecai. So definitely wanted to mention that, although not as much of a slam dunk as some of the other ones. The Bible is real, actual, factual history. In these pages is reliable, testable information. In these pages are given an accurate, precise account of the events of the world. The Bible should not be believed, or the Bible should be believed, not because one simply feels that it should be believed, but because it has been shown repeatedly to be accurate. It has been repeatedly proven and confirmed. Your faith and our faith is not groundless. Far from it. The Bible speaks of another historical event that impacts every single one of us and everyone who has ever lived. It tells us that God inhabited flesh and dwelt among us in the form of Jesus of Nazareth. And the Bible shares that Jesus taught with authority and performed miracles to confirm his identity as the only begotten Son of God. The Bible tells us that Jesus volunteered to die on the cross for our sins so that we can be reconciled to God in spite of our numerous violations of his will. The Bible tells us that Jesus has a place prepared for us to be in eternal fellowship with him, with the Father, and with the Holy Spirit. And the Bible tells us to access these blessings more and more, that we must believe the gospel. We must confess Jesus as Lord and Savior. We must change our pattern of thinking and pattern of life. We must be immersed in water and live faithfully until our time comes to depart this corruptible flesh. And if we humbly accept and submit to that, we can be sure that God's great gift of grace, salvation from sins, is ours. So, do you want to be assured of heaven? Do you want to be assured of the forgiveness of sins? Why not? As together we stand and sing.